Okay, welcome to the last day with labs. Today we will talk about some alternative persistence methods, remote access techniques, reconnaissance about Windows credentials and remote command execution. I got a little bit ahead of myself yesterday, so some repetition should be good. We will only work on lab 5 today, but I have also released lab 6, so if you're interested and able to continue working on more exercises, then you can do it on your own time. Lab 6 will not be a part of the exam. So, what most persistence techniques on Windows on a Windows platform involve the use of the registry or Windows servers. But malware also has some clever alternative persistence mechanisms. So the first is to add an .exe file to the startup folder, either for each user or for all. And depending on the Windows version, this folder is located in different places. Adding a program to the Windows Windows startup folder would cause the program to be executed when a user logs in. The program will then be executed under the context of that user as with that user's permissions levels. But the starter folder is not limited only to programs. There's something called LNK files, which is a shortcut file used by Windows to point to executables. So in this example, the malicious link uses a directory traversal attack to then go back and execute a different different .exe file with its own parameters. So that this link points to the Windows scripting host, which can interpret both Visual Basic scripts and Microsoft's own implementation of JavaScript. Here it creates an ActiveX object to create an instance of the Internet Explorer and open this URL. The connection to the remote system allows for command and control functionality without the need to create or execute any malicious files on the system. It also does not require any register keys or settings to automatically load on startup. So this JavaScript allowed their remote system to use or to execute a command via the command prompt. So some repetition from yesterday. The Windows system uses a common method to look for required the DLLs to load into a program. And malware authors can take advantage of this search order to then place at the DLL file higher up up in the search order with the the same file name as the or the good DLL. It will first search with the register key, which have a mapping of a few known DLLs. If it's not found in this list, it will continue searching in the directory where the application is loaded. In the system 32 folder, in the system folder from the system root, and finally current working directory as well as any path variables. So and again, it will load the first DLL with the same name as it is searching for. There are some required conditions for a DLL search order hijacking. The first is that the DLL is not in the list of known DLLs. It's not in the same folder as the executable, and it's not loaded from an absolute path within the .exe file. So, for example, explorer.exe will load the NTS. HR UI DLL file from the system 32 folder, but let's assume for the moment that this DLL is not found within the list of known DLLs. It's certainly not within the directory for the executable. And it's not loaded from an absolute path. So an attacker can place a malicious DLL with the same file name in the directory which will be searched for before system 32. So that this will cause the operating system to then use this malicious DLL instead of the system 32 one. Another way for malware to gain persistence is by replacing system binaries. Rabbit is a technique, the malware patches a byte to a system binary to then force it to run that malware the next the time it's the infected binary is run or loaded. Malware authors typically target system the binaries that is used frequently. The DLLs are a popular target. So a system binary is typically modified in a way that it will enter the malicious file first, and modified in such a way that it doesn't that destroyed the original function of that system binary. So when the malware code is launched, it will return to the original DLL code. So everything operates as it did before before the patch. Here is an example, but I did not find any information on it online. But you can see that the CTFMOM has been modified to load a malicious DLL backdoor. Some ways to identify these persistence methods is to do a timeline analysis, see if the processes have loaded any suspicious DLLs, validating digital signatures and hashes of executables, and finally look for any binaries which is loaded from the wrong path. So having continuous access to a system is a hassle, and so sometimes additional backdoors isn't enough. As an attacker, you will always have to contend with plan maintenance and updates, which can change anything that you have done. So, for example, using the previous example again, the CTFMOM executable. If Windows then suddenly updates this .exe file under a regular update schedule, then your persistence is lost. There are also a lot of other technologies which can detect your presence, such as antivirus and host intrusion detection or prevention systems. And then you have the companies usually monitor their networks, and then you have the digital forensics analysts. Targeted attacks are increasingly using VPN and pivoting as a way for remote access. So pivoting means to use an already existing compromised system to find a way into further into an internal network. Attackers often use VPN as a communication channel to make it more difficult for instance, expert to analyze them, because the communication is encrypted, and it's often blends in with other network traffic. A VPN can authenticate a user based on either something they know, or something they have, or something they are. And the single factor authentication methods only use one of these three. Well, multi-factor, I use at least the two of them, and sometimes all three. Single factor authentication is easier for an attacker to gain access to if they have the domain credentials or password. It's easy to utilize the company's own VPN to extract valuable data. Using the two-factor authentication makes it more difficult for the attacker to have both authentication methods, but not impossible. So one way to identify suspicious activity or VPN connections is through the VPN logs. For example, if an employee will both work and live in the same city and has not been on a vacation for some time, then it should pop up a red flag when his VPN connection is used from a completely different place. Companies also have standardized naming convention for their systems. So a host names that does not match this naming convention can also be suspicious. The same goes for inconsistent VPN client versions. And if one user is logged on from multiple IP addresses, so this also includes into the time. So, for example, if one in the morning or in America on IP there, and in the afternoon is from an IP from Europe, and this is usually something suspicious. Everyone has heard that they should not reuse passwords over a long period of time. When you have a password with an expiry date, the attacker needs to periodically redump passwords to maintain access to your system. So this additional activity you force on the attacker, I will then increase the likelihood for detecting them. So DMZ or demilitarized zone is an old concept where you have a less secure and trusted network, where you have a less secure or trusted network segment. I wish you are reachable through the internet. For example, to have some services for your employees, such as a VPN or a website. The problem is that the DMZ segment has a connection to the internal network. Usually through a firewall, so an attacker can have the ability to take control over computers or applications in the DMZ, and from there find a way to pivot into your internal networks. One example of this is to install a web shell on the web server. So web shells are malicious web scripts that can provide functionality such as file transfer, command execution, network reconnaissance, and so forth. So web shells are often installed after a domain compromise. So the attacker has access to an infected system on internal network additional backdoor malware. Then it can use this connection to then have a lateral movement over to the web server and install a web shell there. He can then have access to this web servers from another source. Without the firewall blocking him, or and it will also most likely not be suspicious within the log files. And then he can then use the web shell to continue reconnaissance and then take over other systems. For this lab, you will need a lab 5 zip folder, but you can find it on the Blackboard. So a short summary: you will have to know where to look for suspicious activity to find it. They are often hidden, so to look as legitimate the actions. And that these are some of the artifacts that you have looked at over these 4 days. And a final note is that the tools are only as good as the writer, so that is why the digital forensics experts like open source tools, is because then we can validate how they work. But you must still learn the artifacts too, and understand how to interpret them, because the tools that doesn't do this for you. So, any questions? No, then you can start on the lab. I'm planning to try to have a summary after you are finished. So when people are starting to be done with lab 5, I would then have a summary about happened on the on the I can't remember the system of what it was called, but the one you have been working for the past 3 days. So it appears that the latest 1.2 of Redline doesn't show the trust status. So if you used Redline from the tools.zip and the 1.14 Redline, I think it should work.
I'm game.
Are people starting to get finished now? Little lab 5? That raise a hand if you ever finished with lab 5.
If you have or have not.
If you are finished. Okay, we can wait a little bit longer. Okay, I think we should just start to wrap up, and then people can go whenever they want. So from lab one, there was an alert that triggered the investigation. Did you find the IP addresses and in any of the processes? Anyone? So, did you find this IP address from the questions? No. Okay. But when you started to look at other browser activities during that time, what did you find?
Goes faster if you guys answer. I promise.
Yes? Yes, he logged into Google Mail and downloaded an attachment from Dropbox. Was there any other read and write activity during this time interval? Yes.
Yeah.
So I'm only going logically. That was a certain Windows folder. A subfolder within Windows under the C volume.
The
add-ins folder, yes. So Had anyone tried to hide their activities from this folder to appear legitimate? And in that case, how? Yes, they tried to delete some files, and they also changed the timestamps. The not the standard information timestamps. Did you find anything interesting from the nc.exe, rar.exe, wget.exe, wce.exe, or and the setmates executables? Or some of them of particular interest? Yes, setmates can edit the timestamps, so that is interesting. What about nc? .exe.
NC was netcat.
Netcat, yes.
Which is used for port scanning, transferring files, and port
listening. Mm-hmm. Yes, in this instance, it has been used as a backdoor. Yes. What about the rar? .exe. Yes, wce.exe is a Windows credential harvester, so that's also interesting. And the rar file is not particularly interesting, but where it's located is. Not the same with wget. Not a lot of Windows users use this program, unless they are familiar with Unix. So, what kind of data was extracted from the system, supposedly with wce program? Yes, Windows login details with the hashed passwords and username. Did the attacker leave some persistence behind on the system? And how? Mm-hmm. But how did he leave it behind?
Just that it had been accessed or executed, and just had an association to the CMDXE. Well, that was at least for a bash file, but all the files have the also
access
files of interest.
Yeah, no, I'm more interested in how he wanted to continue to use the system, the persistence. How did he do it?
Oh yeah, he modified
MC.exe. Yes, he modified the registry rand key. So it will be automatically loaded when the user logs in. And the attacker used the RAR to combine several of the files and then send it out. Do anyone know the password?
Lol.
So. Large L, zero, and lower case L. What was the contents of the WAD files, and how did you tell? What was the content of the WAD files? WAD. Yes, that they were executable files. And how did you find that out? Yes, you did look for a magic number in the header. So, I think we have covered everything for between lab 1 and 4. So, for 5... I have no kind of particular questions for lab 5. But do you have anything that you want to say about it? Or? Okay. Then I think we are done for today. You can stay if you want. I just want to say that lab 1 to 5 is can be exam material, but nothing specific, and also the slides. The lab 6 will not be on the exam. Okay, thank you, and have a good weekend.